What do you guys want?
Let me get a bacon, egg, and cheese on a hard roll with a side order of fries, cheese, and gravy, and a bowl of gravy on the side.
I'll have the same thing plus pancakes.
And I'll make it two.
I'll have an egg white omelet made with very little oil, dry wheat toast, and grapefruit juice.
Oh, my God. That's the gayest order I ever heard.
You know, in Massachusetts, that order could legally marry a dude.
All right, here comes.
You know, just placing an order like that can get you kicked out of the army.
Now, if you put a construction helmet on that order, it could join the village people.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? My name is Phil. This is My Life as a Foodie. Did you guys see that sickeningly sweet open letter that Tony Bourdain wrote to Rachel Ray? Holy crap, man. What the hell happened to all the hate that Tony used to have? I mean, she's a good person. She really is. I always said that. He went on a long trip with his wife and his daughter, and they came home to an empty refrigerator. And there was this basket of fruit and a nice note from Rachel Ray, who I guess his wife has become friends with. So that night, his daughter, instead of being hungry and grumpy, was able to nosh on fresh fruit, and Rachel Ray saved the day. So he writes this nice long post, this open letter, thanking her and what a nice person she is. A nice gesture, it really is. And she is a very nice person. And I'm glad he sees that, but man, I blame his wife for softening him up. She must be shit hot, because this guy has done an about-face. You women, man, you've got some serious mojo working to get us to do some of the things we do. Hell, man, I was watching Oprah. You know, well, who am I to talk? Anyway, welcome back to the show. I got some incredibly nice feedback on the last show from Kirk in England, who was commenting on shows for a while. And then I stopped hearing from him. And honestly, I thought I'd said something that pissed him off, which I would completely understand if that was the case. But it turns out he left this incredibly thoughtful comment on last episode's post that he hit a bit of a rough patch. But he made it through on the other side. He's got a new job, a new career. And he said that My Life as a Foodie helped him get through those tough times. And that when he needed an escape, that this was there for him. And that made me feel really good. Let me tell you something. To know that the show is entertaining enough to keep someone and helping them through a rough patch, maybe one of the toughest things you can go through, losing your job. And that's a real big endorsement. And that's all I really need to hear. So thank you, Kirk, for saying those nice things. That was really nice. You could easily have kept that in, but I appreciate you sharing it. So you all know by now that Katrina and I recently went to The Bazaar by Jose Andreas here in Beverly Hills. Peter and Joe from MyLastBite.com got us a reservation through Open Table. And it turns out that they were not only there for opening night, but they were there for the very first reservation for The Bazaar. And I can tell you guys this much. Joe loves that place, and they love her back. She wears that place like a coat. And what a place it is, too. Oh. It's worth the price of admission, folks. You valet park at the SLS Hotel on La Cienega Boulevard. You walk in and boom, it's an instant art gallery. It's hard to say it's an art gallery. It's an art gallery. There's art everywhere. It's hard to even describe what sensory overload the place is. You have to stare at stuff for long periods of time to soak it all in. You walk in, right? Dead center. You walk right into Bar Centro. It's a high-end bar with classic lighting, very thoughtful the way the lighting is all set up, elegant furniture, a big giant wall right at the back of the bar. It's lit a really dark yellow with silhouettes of all the bottles and people standing in front of it. It demands your attention. All the light just sucks your attention in. And there's this long table where you can sit and drink and watch really old film footage right on the table, like the little LCD screens that are embedded underneath the table that play loops of old films. Really thought out. And the artwork everywhere is kind of off, you know? I said, like, Mark Ryden off. And I mentioned Mark Ryden, which about, like, 2% of the people that I know would even know who I was talking about. Peter says, yeah, very much like Mark Ryden. Like, he knew who Mark Ryden was. I mean, he was cool. I knew this dude was cool. And that just, you know, just made him cooler. Anyway, so there are several parts to this place. there's Bar Centro, where you drink before you eat. And then there's Rojo y Blanco, which is basically two rooms, a white room and a red room. They're both dining areas where food is served to you. Blanco, the white room, seems very standard, elegant, just kind of like a regular restaurant, but very elegant. And for the lack of a better description, I would say missionary position. Okay? We ate at Rojo. And I would suggest it's the only place you eat if you go there and you only go once. Because that is where the kitchen is. That's where the VIP section is. That's where all the life in the place is. Rojo is the antithesis of missionary position. It's whatever position you want. The lighting's more radical. The atmosphere is better. You can watch the chefs do their thing. And you can talk to them if you happen to be Joe, who knows everybody. She knows every chef, all the sous chefs. They all know her. They come to the table, shook her hand. Michael's the head chef. Oof, man, that guy's got some talent. And then after your meal, you're escorted by another waiter or maitre d' down the hall to the patisserie, where you sit, you have dessert, your coffee, and you finish your night. There's tons of art there, sculptures, high-end stuff that you won't see anywhere else. And I like this. You know, dinner's over, and instead of bringing you a dessert menu, they bring you to the dessert menu. Does that make sense? You get up, you walk a little bit, you sit down, you finish your evening, pay your bill, get your car from valet, and you go home. So I should just tell you that I went into the evening thinking about what Chef Young had said. You know, I'm not here to feed you. I'm not here to fill your belly. I'm here to entertain you. So with these tapas plates at around 8 to 20 bucks a piece, some a little more, but, you know, reasonable, $8, $12 is about the norm. Small bites of really interesting things. 3-4 on a plate. And I expected to be entertained, to get a food experience, but not come away feeling like a stuffed pig. But I was wrong. Again, I'm, you know, crying uncle about 3/4 of the way into the meal, because I just can't eat that much. Tapas sounds great. To me, tapas sounds like the perfect meal. It's appetizers. It's finger food. It's eating a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Like Bourdain said when he went to Spain, the San Sebastian episode. You know, when you go to tapas, you got to be careful, because if I eat too much of this, then I can't have some of this. It's finger food, so, you know, as you sit down, you're eating together, you're sharing. It's how the Asians eat, and I love how the Asians eat. It's more personal. Everybody sits at the table and you share. It's deep. It's romantic if you're on a date. But I'll give you the list of things I remember eating. It's ungodly, because one of these doesn't sound like a whole lot until you're picking yourself up off the floor from, you know, realizing you've had 20 of them. But we let Joe order because she's been there like 9 times, and she's eaten so many things on the menu that she actually wrote down on a small post all the things she had not eaten, only to find out that they added a couple more dishes. But her and Peter, they know the menu very, very well. They know how much to order. They know what everything is, what it tastes like. And based on what we'll eat, and I'll eat anything, and I do mean anything, she knows, or and her and Peter will be able to tell you what's going to be popular or unpopular for the table and how much food that we're going to need. Oh, and dragon's breath. Let me tell you about this. Fox 11 News here in Los Angeles sends this cute Japanese field reporter that I just think is completely hot, Jane Yamamoto. Sends her to the bazaar last week to do a story, and he's given her all these tasty bites to eat, and he finishes her off with dragon's breath. Dragon's breath is caramelized popcorn that's dipped into a bowl of liquid nitrogen. You eat it right away, and then when you bite into it, this nitrogen steam just comes pouring out of your mouth, your nose, everywhere. You remember those cartoons when someone would eat a hot pepper, and the next thing you know, this alarm is going off, his face goes bright red, steam's coming out of the ears, the nose, their ass. It's like that. But I copied the audio, and I'm going to play it for you. There's about 5 minutes of audio. Here's the audio from the report from Fox 11 News. For those of you who may have missed the video, which Joe posted on MyLastBite.com.
It's the hottest restaurant in town, virtually impossible to get a table. But we got inside for a taste of Spain right here in Beverly Hills. Jane Yamamoto joins us live from inside the bazaar. Jane, got to tell me, what makes this so hot?
Well, Michael, it is a hot, unique dining experience all the way around. We are inside the kitchen here at the bazaar. The man behind all of this, world-renowned chef Jose Andres. And chef, first off, what makes it so unique? Tapas style, right?
Well, tapas, what can I tell you, Jane, is the best way to eat. And here at the bazaar, tapas are little dishes from Spain that is the perfect thing to have a
How
big party.
How many do you have here in all on the menu?
In the menu, 70, 80. So when you come, you order 3, 4, 5 per person.
Okay, and let's get to it. What do we have here?
Okay, before we start eating, okay, we need to start drinking.
We have to start drinking.
Take a look what we have here. The magic mojito.
Magic, okay.
You see the cotton candy?
This looks like a dessert.
But
no,
it's not.
No, it's not.
Do you see it?
I see it.
Take a look, because now this magic mojito is disappearing right in your eyes. Don't tell me this is not cute.
Oh, that's cute.
And so tasty.
That's looking really good.
Drink it.
Drink it? Okay, here we go.
Yeah, no one is watching. So
no one's watching. Okay.
Go. Are you hungry?
I'm starved.
You want
tapas? Wow, that's good. That is okay. Here we go. Let's go.
I need tapas right away.
Yes, sir.
Let's go now.
And now, how has your influence helped on this? From Spain, you're originally from Spain, so how has that changed your style?
Wow, take a look at all of these. Well, this is a mix of tapas from Spain. Like, for example, you see over there, this is the Iberico ham, the best ham that you can eat anywhere, served with a very traditional tomato bread.
Okay.
But also, we can move away from Spain, and let me show you here.
International flavors here.
You see, it's a tuna ceviche with avocado. Take a look how sexy this dish really is.
That's a sexy, hot-looking dish, don't you think? Okay, well, what else we have here?
This one. I love this. You see these cans?
Uh-huh.
That's very traditional in Spain. But here, we do it with king, crab, leg, and raspberries.
Okay.
Really tasty.
I'm going to try this one.
Take a look at this.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to try this one. Oh, wow. That is
so
amazing.
Imagine you come with your friends.
The
and
flavor.
You can order 80 different things. Everyone finds something you like.
And we have to talk about this because we're in the kitchen here, and if you take a wide shot over there, you can see there is a dining experience on the other side, another dining room. And if you have a sweet tooth, you have to go to the dessert bar. And the chef, he showed me that just a few minutes ago. Take a look at what I experienced. So now we have made our way into the pastry area, right?
Yep. We call this the patisserie.
Patisserie.
In French, well, the pastry shop.
And what do we have here?
Well, take a look. This is almost like Willy Wonka. All kinds of different chocolates, cookies. Oh, that's my favorite. Over here.
Which one is it?
Are you hungry? This is, we call it after 8. Chocolate.
And you can eat it only after 8?
No, it has the mint leaf inside. Eat it. The whole thing. Come on,
okay.
Jane. Don't be shy. People
okay.
are not watching. It's good or no?
It's okay. So good.
Contain yourself, please.
Okay.
What
I'm
else?
Trying.
Oh, these ones over here. Saffron. Take a look at those. You see this paper?
Mm-hmm.
It's rice paper. It's edible.
Like Japanese.
Like Japanese. Mm-hmm. Open your mouth again. You're going to eat it. Come on. I need to feed you.
And can I combine all of my flavors? That's okay?
Oh, yeah. Go in.
Okay. And I can eat the paper?
All the way in. Oh, the beautiful aroma of saffron in your mouth. Now the chocolate, the mint.
I'm tasting it.
Are you not getting like, say, this is so good.
It's so good.
Okay, one more.
Okay.
One more. We made these white chocolate tablets inspired in the trees of the Getty Museum right here in L.A.
That's the inspiration.
That was inspiration, and you're going to eat it right now.
Okay, and who knew that the trees of the Getty Center could be so tasty? What do I have going here?
Boneless chicken wing.
Oh, my gosh.
This is not good.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, we have one more thing that he wants to show me real quick. I'm not
this
supposed to talk about that. Okay, here we go.
It's going to change your life forever.
Life changing,
it's
okay.
It's going to change your life forever. Come with me.
Okay.
Take a look at this. This is liquid nitrogen.
Oh, no.
And this over here.
And I can eat this?
It's caramelized popcorn.
Here we go.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready for this. Here we go.
Your life is
going to
change.
Are you watching this, Michael? Christine, watch
we
very
put
carefully.
This in the liquid nitrogen. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay.
5 seconds.
The countdown is on.
This is getting very, very cold. We call this dragon breath.
Okay.
Are you
because
ready?
Because.
Hold on. Grab one.
I'm grabbing one.
Hold on. Look at me. Look at me.
Okay.
Look at me.
Okay,
concentrate.
I'm looking. I'm concentrating.
One, two, three.
Two, three.
Eat it.
Oh, I don't want to go right away.
We're pumping into you.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Okay. She cannot talk anymore, so I'm going to say bye to everyone here in L.A. You did good. You did really good.
Oh.
It's cold.
Oh, no.
It's cold.
I think she likes
you. Wow, Brad was amazing.
Is she okay? I can't tell.
Are you not having fun in the studio or what?
And she's freaking out when she bites into this. I mean, it's hilarious. It looks like you're a fire-breathing dragon, except that it's smoke. So anyway, that airs, and then the next night, people are rushing into the place. They're ordering the stuff by the bucketful. And Jose Andreas fears that the demand might be too high for it, that it's going to become too common, people are going to get tired of it, so he terminates it from the menu. So it's off for now. We didn't have it, because it went off. And we don't know when it's going to come back. And I respect that he did that, because it's a cool dish. And it should stay a cool dish. Let it rest. Let it make another appearance later. And maybe we'll have it next time. Anyway, I made a list here. Here's what we had, I think, in order. I can't remember. My brain is really still kind of fuzzy. So bear with me here. I wrote it down as I could remember eating it. First thing we had, tomato bread, which is a very simple tapas. It's grilled crusty bread with a little olive oil. And then they shred fresh tomato on top. It's an excellent start. Very good. And I got a piece of it caught in my throat and started coughing immediately. So that was a good start. Sweet potato chips with a dip that's made of yogurt, tamarind, and star anise. Now, these were really delicious. Sweet potato chips, really delicious. And the star anise in the yogurt made it taste kind of like a cannoli. I love that taste because that reminded me of Christmas when I was a little boy. Then next comes something I never thought I'd even get a chance to taste. Jamón Ibérico de Palota. That sounded Italian, but it's Spanish. 2 ounces of the infamous acorn-fed free-range Ibérico ham. Ibérico, sorry. Well, this is the stuff of legends. This is the leg of the dark-hoofed pig that's allowed to graze along the forest floor and eat all the acorns that it wants. And the result is something that resembles Serrano ham, lightly salted, so it's slightly less salty than you'd, definitely saltier than prosciutto. And Serrano ham is a lot more mild than prosciutto. Of this stuff, melts in your mouth like butter on hot toast. Simply unbelievable. I couldn't believe I was eating it. I closed my eyes when I had it. I let it melt in my mouth. I could have stopped right here and completely would have been happy. And with that came a cheese plate of assorted cheeses, including manchego and other hard cheeses. But the one in particular that stood out to me was La Serena, which is a sharp cheese, really runny. It was stinky chunk la funk of all cheeses. It made my hair stand up. That freaking good. Creamy, a little bitter, kind of funked out. A stink fest. I love it. I love it. You all know my affection for stinky runny cheese, and this hit it. And Joe's just setting us up perfectly. I mean, we got palate cleansers here. Literally, that's what they are, palate cleansers. So then up next was one of my two favorite dishes of the night. It was cotton candy foie gras. It's a cube of foie gras, which is goose liver, crusted with crushed corn nuts, placed on a stick, and then wrapped in cotton candy. Maron, this was heavenly. I shut my eyes on this one, too. I think I made the O face. I can't recall. It was so good, man. Then we had Not Your Everyday Caprese, which I had done a similar take on this past weekend. I did a post on the site if you want to check it out. It was nowhere near as well done as this, but it's exactly how I'm going to try to do it next time. And we even talked to the chef. Of course, you know, Joe's brave. She calls the chef. She goes, hey, how'd you do the mozzarella? You know, there were little cherry tomatoes cooked and skinned along with this liquid mozzarella ball. And he explains that they're liquefied mozzarella that already have calcium in them, so they don't need any calcic. And they liquefy the balls and they dip it into alginate bath and they allow it to form a hard skin. I think they let it sit in there for a long time so it forms a really hard skin. Then they rinse them and they serve them with tomatoes over a bed of pesto. Delicious, clean, and it's caprese, which I love. We had a dish of cooked Brussels sprout leaves that were served with a lemon puree, apricots, grapes, and then topped with lemon air. Now this was refreshing, really clean, delicious. I mean, I love when vegetables are lightly cooked, still vibrant, but soft enough and not destroyed. I mean, it's perfect. The lemon air was really nice and intense. So I think they may have even cooked that down a little bit to intensify the flavor before they made the air. Then Joe ordered a dish of Catalan pork sausage. Is it Catalan? I don't even know how to say that. And then there were white beans that came with that and mushrooms, and it resembled kind of a cassoulet. And the sausage was fantastic. It was like a garlic sausage, similar to what I use in cassoulet. And the beans had a nice crust on them, like rich, buttery breadcrumbs. I swear, this could be Spanish cassoulet, if that exists. That was good. Don't eat too much of that. You'll definitely get full. Then comes something that, man, I'll tell you, me and fried foods, I love it, but it knocks me out. They brought in a plate of codfish fritters that arrived with a honey aioli, and it started to do me in just a little bit. Right about now, when I start eating fritters and fried things, this is when my stomach starts sending these signals. But they're so damn good, you know, you just want to keep eating them. It's like chicken wings. I mean, this was clean cod. Almost seemed ashamed to dip it in sauce. But I did it because the girls told me to, and I do whatever they tell me. But this was like that punch to the jaw that weakened you just a little bit. You know, you left yourself open. It doesn't knock you to the mat. But it makes you think, if you took another punch like that, if you took one inside, if the cook got inside just one more time, you might be in trouble. So this might not go 12 rounds if you do too many of these. Another cool thing were the mozzarella tomato pipettes. Now, the menu said that they were served with microbasil and instructions. And you needed instructions because they were the same skinless cherry tomatoes we had in the Caprese. But they were skewered on these little plastic pipettes, which look like the little eyedroppers that you use in chemistry class. And those pipettes are filled with the liquefied mozzarella. So you stick the tomato in your mouth, take it off the pipette, and at the same time suck and squeeze on the pipette and squirt liquid mozzarella right into your mouth. It's like one big Caprese, but it's an interactive Caprese. And it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen done. Oh, and Joe, of course, takes the pipettes home with her, and I don't blame her. I told her when they run out of the pipettes, she should try to sell them back to them, because they're hard to find. That's great. She's filling her purse with pipettes. Ajo Blanco is a white gazpacho with tomatoes, grapes, and raisins. Now, Katrina loved this one, and I can totally see why, because it was really clean. The puree was smooth, it was clean, the grapes and raisins, chopped almonds. It was served in a little bowl with some flowers on top. It provides a really nice mix. And it included the caviar of tomato, which is that thing that Jose talks about. The little part of the tomato. The best part of the tomatoes, this little gel inside of the tomato, contains all the seeds. So you open the door of the tomato, you peek inside, you scoop out the little, tiny little piece of you know, flesh with the seeds in them, and then you eat it. That's the tomato. He says the rest of it, that's fluff. You know, this inside, this caviar of tomatoes, that's the money shot. And that was great. So then next comes the dish that both Katrina and I had near the top of our list. Croquetas de pollo. They're fritters. They look like tater tots. Well, no, what Peter said. They look like tater tots, but they're far from being tater tots. No other description. Just let them cool a little bit. Put them in your mouth. Eat it. Tell me what you taste. And you know what it was? It was chicken and bechamel sauce, battered, dipped in panko or breadcrumbs, and then deep fried. They tasted just like chicken pot pie. It exploded in your mouth with chicken pot pie. I don't know how they kept it together. It's magic. I have no idea how they do this stuff. And again, this is another one of those filling dishes. Sticks to your ribs, but another shot to the jaw. You know, I told Joe I was starting to hit the wall, and I think I disappointed her. Seriously, I started to think, I'm not going to keep up. How many more dishes are we going to have? Then come boneless chicken wings, which looked and tasted just like a chicken wing that had been deboned. And you know my infatuation with chicken wings anyway. I pride myself on the chicken wings that I make, but I love any chicken wings. This was delicious and not hot. You know, in fact, I expected to eat some spicy dishes here, and I didn't get any of those. Another dish we had that kind of threw me over the bridge was braised veal cheeks that were served with California oranges and a natural jus. Because eating a baby cow is not tender enough. Let's eat the cheeks. I mean, good Christ. Food isn't supposed to taste this good. I mean, this was a dish that would turn anybody into a baby killer. I mean, if you got a problem killing animals before they're a year old, you need to taste veal cheeks. Better yet, braised veal cheeks. And this is unfair. I mean, I wish I had an entire plate of these with some boiled potatoes and a glass of Pinot Noir. I'd go right to bed. That would be it. That's a good meal. Jose comes up with this idea of a Philly cheesesteak that I think he made it just to piss off Philadelphia. And you know what? It's okay with me. It's air bread, which is like a miniature loaf of bread that has so much leavening that the inside of it is hollow. And it's good because they fill the inside with creamed white cheddar cheese. This was topped with small little rounds of very thinly sliced seared Wagyu beef. Good night, see you in the morning. I had not only tasted jamón ibérico for the first time in my life, I was now tasting Wagyu, the closest thing any of us are going to come to Kobe. I mean, you know, we talked about this on our show, on the last show, I think. It was bar none, best beef ever. Just like the Iberico, it melts in your mouth. Overhyped? Whatever you say. You just need to taste something like this. You taste this and you tell me this is overhyped. It was truly great. And what a great idea. And I hope Philadelphia's taking notice, because Jose just fucked with your sandwich. And he kicked its ass. That was so good, man. And I didn't want to eat it. And Peter talked me into it. And I'm glad he did. My brain said no, and Peter said yes. And Peter was right. Somewhere in all this madness comes the coup de grace, the best thing I had all night, and maybe the best thing I'll put in my mouth for a very long time. It was a little sandwich, about half the size of a White Castle burger, to kind of give you an idea. It was a little mini steamed bun. It wasn't cooked, it was steamed, and it was filled with uni, which is sea urchin roe. And next to monkfish liver, uni is the foie gras of the sea. It had these little slivers of avocado and jalapeno pepper in it, fresh, as if it were just picked from the garden. Unbelievable. The smallest, tastiest little fish sandwich I've ever eaten. Not filet of fish. Uni buns. That's the sandwich of the future. That's the new fish sandwich. The last thing that came to our table, which I thought was spectacular, is something new at the bazaar. It's smoked sous vide salmon with cucumber noodles. These are pureed cucumbers with algin or agar-agar. And then they squirt them into a calcium solution from a syringe or a squeeze bottle. So they're like little cucumber noodles, cold. And they come on a slate of granite covered in a big glass top that's full of smoke from alderwood. And it's delivered with a smoke machine, then topped really quickly. So the smoke is really light, but it's just right there, and it smells really good. It was kick-ass. I mean, I never had anything cooked sous vide before, so this was another treat for me. Sous vide is that process of cooking things in vacuum-sealed bags in a water bath. And then the water bath circulates around the meat at a really low temperature for extended periods of time. So like a water bath, say at like 140 degrees for 6 hours, it cooks the flesh without marking it. And it's tender all the way through. And there's a high chance of overcooking salmon anyway. So it tends to finish way too dry. And this was not that way, not even close. This, I would think, would be what you'd call a perfectly cooked piece of salmon. So because we're special guests of Joe and Peter, the escort takes us to the patisserie to have dessert, drink coffee, and then look at all the artwork and finish our night. He incidentally shows us a little special room, and I'm not going to tell any of you where it is, but it's a VIP room that was empty, but that's where the celebrities are let in through a magic door, and they can eat their meal at the bazaar and very, you know, in peace and not be bothered, and it's a nice touch. And it's something I would imagine is prevalent in any high-end restaurant in Beverly Hills. I mean, you want to attract the stars to your restaurant, but you want to make sure they're not bothered. So this was thoughtful to actually make a room like this. So dessert is really not my thing, but the girls, you know, they like it. And man, there was some great stuff served there, including a coconut ball that was cooked in liquid nitrogen. So it was iced coconut on the outside and coconut cream on the inside. It was just nuts. And some chocolate-covered pop rocks that were really, really cool. You put them in your mouth. You bite down on it and then let it melt. And the pop rocks just start to explode in your mouth. Just a great night of eating and laughing and hanging out with the chefs. And it was so, so cool. Let me wrap it up. I'm going to tell you that if you're in Southern California, you must visit the bazaar. If you're coming here on vacation, you must visit the bazaar. Go at least once. Get a table, order four or five tapas apiece, and then share with each other. You'll spend about $100, $120. But it'll be well worth it because, yeah, it is entertainment, but it's also about flavor and experience things that you may not really taste anywhere else. The Iberico, the Wagyu, the molecular tricks. No one's doing this. And nowhere can you experience it for so little. Really, it's worth it, believe me. It's definitely a place I would return to. I wouldn't think not to return to it, knowing that it's such a memorable place to enjoy food and to enjoy your friends and dine. And they make you feel special while you're there. And while you're there, you are special. I mean, Jose is a genius. He's a genius. He's a very good restaurateur. The head chef, Michael, not to be matched. He's unique in his style, his presence, his ability to make it all look easy. I mean, that team of chefs, they work together flawlessly. Not a single problem. No one ever blew their lid. It's a restaurateur at the top of his game who hires an executive chef at what appears to be the top of his game, running a kitchen full of chefs at the top of their game, in a restaurant designed by somebody at the top of his game. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. It came together perfectly for me. TheBazaar.com. BAZAAR.com. Make your reservations online at OpenTable.com or directly from the restaurant's website, TheBazaar.com. So right after the last episode was released, a big announcement is made because that's what happens the minute I finish a show. You know, more big news comes out, which is a good thing. It means things are happening, you know, in the world of food. But President Obama has named Margaret Hamburg head of the FDA, and we were waiting for this announcement. So if, in case you missed it, here's President Obama.
I've often said that I don't believe government has the answer to every problem or that it can do all things for all people. We're a nation built on the strength of individual initiative. But there are certain things that we can't do on our own. There are certain things only government can do. And one of those things is ensuring that the foods we eat and the medicines we take are safe and don't cause us harm. That's the mission of our Food and Drug Administration. And it is a mission shared by our Department of Agriculture and a variety of other agencies and offices at just about every level of government. The men and women who inspect our foods and test the safety of our medicines are chemists and physicians, veterinarians and pharmacists. It's because of the work they do each and every day that the United States is one of the safest places in the world to buy groceries at a supermarket or pills at a drugstore. Unlike citizens of so many other countries, Americans can trust that there is a strong system in place to ensure that the medications we give our children will help them get better, not make them sick, and that a family dinner won't end in a trip to the doctor's office. But in recent years, we've seen a number of problems with the food making its way to our kitchen tables. In 2006, it was contaminated spinach. In 2008, it was salmonella in peppers and possibly tomatoes. And just this year, bad peanut products led to hundreds of illnesses and cost 9 people their lives. A painful reminder of how tragic the consequences can be when food producers act irresponsibly and government is unable to do its job. Worse, these incidents reflect a troubling trend that's seen the average number of outbreaks from contaminated produce and other foods grow to nearly 350 a year, up from 100 a year in the early 1990s. Part of the reason is that many of the laws and regulations governing food safety in America have not been updated since they were written in the time of Teddy Roosevelt. It's also because our system of inspection and enforcement is spread out so widely among so many people that it's difficult for different parts of our government to share information, work together, and solve problems. And it's also because the FDA has been underfunded and understaffed in recent years, leaving the agency with the resources to inspect just 7,000 of our 150,000 food processing plants and warehouses each year. That means roughly 95% of them go uninspected. That's a hazard to public health. It's unacceptable, and it will change under the leadership of Dr. Margaret Hamburg, who I'm appointing today as Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. From her research on infectious disease at the National Institutes of Health, to her work on public health at the Department of Health and Human Services, to her leadership on biodefense at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, Dr. Hamburg brings to this vital position not only a reputation of integrity, but a record of achievement in making Americans safer and more secure. Dr. Hamburg was one of the youngest people ever elected to the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine, and her two children have a unique distinction of their own. Their birth certificates feature her name twice, once as their mother and once as New York City Health Commissioner. In that role, Dr. Hamburg brought a new life to a demoralized agency, leading an internationally recognized initiative that cut the tuberculosis rate by nearly half and overseeing food safety in our nation's largest city. Joining her as Principal Deputy Commissioner will be Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. As Baltimore's Health Commissioner, Dr. Sharfstein has been recognized as a national leader for his efforts to protect children from unsafe over-the-counter cough and cold medications. And he's designed an award-winning program to ensure that Americans with disabilities had access to prescription drugs. Their critical work, and the critical work of the FDA they lead, will be part of a larger effort taken up by a new food safety working group I'm creating. This working group will bring together cabinet secretaries and senior officials to advise me on how we can upgrade our food safety laws for the 21st century, foster coordination throughout our government, and ensure that we are not just designing laws that will keep the American people safe, but enforcing them. And I expect this group to report back to me with recommendations as soon as possible. As part of our commitment to public health, our Agriculture Department is closing a loophole in the system to ensure that diseased cows don't find their way into the food supply. And we're also strengthening our food safety system and modernizing our labs with a $1 billion investment, a portion of which will go towards significantly increasing the number of food inspectors, helping ensure that the FDA has the staff and support they need to protect the food we eat. In the end, food safety is something I take seriously, not just as your president, but as a parent. When I heard peanut products were being contaminated earlier this year, I immediately thought of my 7-year-old daughter, Sasha, who has peanut butter sandwiches for lunch probably 3 times a week. No parent should have to worry that their child is going to get sick from their lunch, just as no family should have to worry that the medicines they buy will cause them harm. Protecting the safety of our food and drugs is one of the most fundamental responsibilities government has. And with the outstanding team I am announcing today, it is a responsibility that I intend to uphold in the months and years to come. Thanks.
It's about time that we saw somebody at least act like they give a damn about us, you know? And the food that we put into our bodies each day, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest. It sure as hell didn't seem like a priority of the previous administration, because we had these problems. We've got problems. As I talk, there is a problem with pistachios. At the end of this whole thing, though, he says, listen, I'll make it personal if I have to. My daughter eats peanut butter and jelly sandwiches a few times a week. And to think that my daughter isn't safe eating her own lunch, especially something she really likes to eat, it's not cool with me. And I'm the goddamn president here. So let's say I get this fixed before my daughter gets sick. And we've been screaming about this for a long time. Where I became confused here was that there was no mention of the proposed Food Safety Administration, or the bill that we talked about on the last show, the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2009. I mean, is that included, or is it a separate thing? Or is this superseded? Does it push it away? I'm not sure. It confused me a little because it came around the same time and then no one said anything about it. But the Obamas are on a roll right now. We're looking at a food revolution starting right in front of our eyes. I'm sure you're all aware of the fact that Michelle Obama, our first lady, planted a vegetable garden at the White House. And this happened around the same time that President Obama made his announcement. I thought this was fantastic. It was in the New York Times, the LA Times, the you name it Times. She was on the cover of Oprah magazine, which I guess was a monumental thing because Oprah only ever has herself on the cover. Now, did I ever think this was actually going to happen this quickly? Talk of victory gardens and a focus on people eating fresh fruits and vegetables over processed food? No, I didn't. I didn't think it was going to happen this quickly. I'm shocked, in fact. We are taking a big, big step in the right direction. It's absolutely incredible that we're putting the focus on farms, farming, eating fresh right out of the gate. They're just starting in the White House, and look what they're doing. I know there are a lot of my listeners who have been very vocal about their distaste for President Obama. I don't share your opinion, but I respect it. I respect that you have the right to have that opinion, and that's what's great about America, and I think it's healthy to challenge opinions. But I'm telling you right now that this is one promising moment for me and for the show, and if it sticks, it will become his legacy. For me, it'll become his legacy. That he helped make a difference and got people on the right track and made farming hip again. If that's what he's left with when he leaves office, and that's maybe just the only thing he has, I'll say, well done, Mr. President. Well done. I like the man. I always have. I'm not afraid to say that. He gets it. So here's our first lady, Michelle Obama, talking to a group of school children on the day that they broke ground for the new garden at the White House.
I want to make sure that our family, as well as the staff, and all the people who come to the White House and eat our food, get access to really fresh vegetables and fruits. Because what I found with my girls, who are 10 and 7, is that they like vegetables more if they taste good, right? And when you grow something right there, I don't know if you've eaten something from your school garden. Who's tasted something from their school garden? What do you think about the difference in the food that you eat from your garden? You think it tastes better? What about you? It looked good when you cooked it, so because it looked good, you wanted to what?
Taste it.
You wanted to taste it, right. And that's what I found with my kids. especially if they were involved in planting it and picking it, they were much more curious about giving it a try. So I've been able to have my kids eat so many different things that they would have never touched if we had bought it at a store, because they either met the farmer that grew it or they saw how it was grown, they were curious about it, and then they tried it, and usually they liked it. And then they'd eat more and more of it. So that's our goal. And we want to do some education with you guys, have you see what the White House kitchen actually looks like, and what can you do creatively with some of these fruits and vegetables. So we are so excited to have you here, because no one has planted a garden like this since Roosevelt was president. And people have done different kinds of gardens, but this is something new and exciting, and we're all excited. Everyone at the White House is thrilled about this, and they are particularly thrilled about the fact that you guys are going to be helping us.
Now listen, our First Lady is no diva, all right? No way. She's in there with a shovel and a pitchfork, getting her hands dirty, raking ground in a dress. She's breaking ground with these kids. She's working it. I mean, she started with a shovel, then went to the pitchfork, and you can see her raking the soil. She's the real deal. She means business. But it doesn't stop there, because there was something else that came out this week. This one was an article in the New York Times, and this caught the ire of Sir Michael Ruhlman. He got a little pissy. Oh, man, he got pissed off. It's a sudden new food revolution that we're starting to see, and Ruhlman just didn't understand why we were making such a big deal about it. From the New York Times, as tens of thousands of people recently strolled among booths of the nation's largest organic and natural food show here, munching on fair trade chocolate and sipping organic wine, a few dozen pioneers of the industry sneaked off to an out-of-the-way conference room. Although unit sales of organic food have leveled off and even declined lately versus a year earlier, the mood among those crowded into the conference room was upbeat as they awaited a private screening of a documentary called Food Inc., a withering critique of agribusiness and industrial processed food. They also gathered to relish their changing political fortunes courtesy of the Obama administration. This has never been just about business, says Gary Herzberg, the executive of Stonyfield Farms, the maker of organic yogurt. We're here to change the world. We dreamt for decades of having this moment. After being largely ignored for years by Washington, advocates of organic and locally grown food have found a receptive ear in the White House, which has vowed to encourage more nutritious and sustainable food supply. The most vocal booster so far has been the First Lady, Michelle Obama, who has emphasized the need for fresh, unprocessed, locally grown food, and last week started work on a White House vegetable garden. More surprising, perhaps, are the pronouncements out of the Department of Agriculture, an agency with long and close ties to agribusiness. In mid-February, Tom Vilsack, the new Secretary of Agriculture, took a jackhammer to a patch of pavement outside his headquarters to create his own organic people's garden. 2 weeks later, the Obama administration named Kathleen Merrigan, an assistant professor at Tufts University and a longtime champion of sustainable agriculture and healthy food, as Mr. Vilsack's top deputy. Mr. Hirschberg and other sustainable food activists are hoping that such actions are precursors to major changes in the way the federal government oversees the nation's food supply and farms, changes that could significantly boost their demand for fresh, local, and organic products. Already, they have offered plenty of ambitious ideas. For instance, the celebrity chef Alice Waters recommends that the federal government triple its budget for school lunches to provide youngsters with healthier food. And the author Michael Pollan has called on President Obama to pursue a reform of the entire food system by focusing on a pollen priority, diversified regional food networks. Still, some activists worry that the dreams of a less processed American diet may soon collide with the realities of Washington and the financial gloom over much of the country. Mr. Pollan, who contributes to the New York Times Magazine, likens sustainable food activists to the environmental movement in the 1970s. Though encouraged by the Obama administration's positions, he worries that food activists may lack political savvy. The movement is not ready for prime time, he says. It's not like we have an infrastructure with legislation ready to go. At the heart of the sustainable food movement is a belief that America has become efficient at producing cheap, abundant food that profits corporations and agribusiness, but is unhealthy and bad for the environment. The federal government is culpable, the activists say, because it pays farmers billions in subsidies each year for growing grains and soybeans. A result is an abundance of corn and soybeans that provide cheap feed for livestock and inexpensive food ingredients like high fructose corn syrup. They argue that farm policy and federal dollars should instead encourage farmers to grow more diverse crops, reward conservation practices, and promote local food networks that rely less on fossil fuels for such things as fertilizer and transportation. So in all of this, this food awareness, where our food comes from, the new food revolution, is this really a bad thing? Because Michael Ruhlman raised a fit. I mean, he seems to think that all this becoming front page news isn't necessary, and the fact that it is a problem. That this becoming mainstream just shows how disconnected our country has gotten to food. And I think he's right. Yeah, that is the point exactly. We have been disconnected. And this is getting us reconnected. I mean, look what a broad leap this is. Okay, maybe it's a fad. Who cares? Who cares if it's a fad? Once people get a taste of what fresh food tastes like, and they stop eating junk and processed food, they'll be less likely to get back into those habits. And the farmers will start to flourish yet again. People are going to farmers markets now more than ever. It's crowded when I go now. The government is getting involved. They're pushing for healthier food choices. The First Lady plants a vegetable garden. And this is necessary. We need this. So I don't see anything negative about this. I only see positive in this. I mean, look at the craft beer industry. If you want an example of this, look at that, that fad. It has had two major surges in its lifetime. The first time happened in the early 90s. We didn't have quite the steam it needed then, and it lost a little bit. But the second surge that we've had now has lasted, 5 to 8 years, and it's gaining momentum like crazy. And it's here to stay, I'm telling you now. This is not going away. And I hope the food thing is here to stay too. I'd like to see more people grow fruits and vegetables, make connections with farmers, make the farmer the rock star, instead of idolizing Ronald McDonald with his bright red hair and the yellow prison suit thing that he wears, or that creepy clown character, the King character from Burger King. We need to direct our attention to people who break their backs and make the one thing that we need every day available to us. We can't live without it. Fresh produce, eggs, dairy, proteins, poultry, pigs, livestock. I think it's important. And I think we're making a difference by demanding more of it. We're in the midst of a new wave of fresh food, and I'd like to see that stick around. Okay, so something occurred to me at the bazaar, and I want to bring this up. I'm an addict when it comes to liver. I realize it now. It's like the richest, fattiest thing I could ever consume. And it's like what chocolate is to, say, like a chocoholic or just somebody who just really craves chocolate. I have to watch how much of it I eat, but I love it. So I wondered, why don't I eat foie gras more than I do? I know it's expensive, but that's not the reason. I think it's because it's either A, hard to find, or B, hard to find. Because it is hard to find. I mean, when was the last time you saw foie gras in a deli section? And when you do find it, it's rare. You don't expect to find it. You're not ready to eat it. You're not ready for it. You don't have any place to keep it refrigerated. It's not a special occasion. And now it's banned in so many places. Good luck. But why is foie gras being banned? I'll tell you why. I put together a little audio thing for you here. We have Roger Moore, James Bond, former 007 agent turned pussy PETA activist, with his balls in his purse, obviously, versus Tony Bourdain, who's an executive chef, tough guy, turned Rachel Ray BFF lately, both giving you their arguments for why you should or should not eat foie gras. The PETA stuff just reeks of PR, but I'm going to let you decide. I'm going to play a little of both, and you can decide. Here, first we have Agent 007.
Hello, I'm Roger Moore for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals with an important message about foie gras. Anyone who has ever seen ducks and geese skimming across a lake in a graceful landing probably knows that these energetic birds are delighted to be alive. They are interesting individuals with distinct personalities who, in the wild, recognize and develop committed, caring relationships with one another. They are meticulously clean and even keep their nests free of debris. Ducks are natural athletes who fly hundreds of miles each year and fly as fast as 60 miles per hour. But on today's foie gras farms, ducks and geese are denied their every desire. They will never even see a lake or stream, never breathe fresh air or feel sun on their backs, and never fly at all. Here they are abused in ways that would be illegal if they were cats or dogs, and they are slaughtered when they are only 3 months old.
Okay, so first of all, if you want to blame anybody about the hierarchy of things, Mr. Bond, you can blame God. All right, because if he didn't want us to eat ducks or geese, he wouldn't have made them so damn delicious. And I wish PETA would stop doing the comparison, treating the animals like you would cats and dogs or your pets, because we don't eat our pets. We're talking about ducks and geese, not cats and dogs. The reason we don't eat cats and dogs is because they taste like shit, dumbass. Have a martini and chill. So here's Rachel Ray's new BFF.
I happen to think that foie gras is one of the most delicious things on earth and one of the 10 most important flavors in gastronomy. And there are a few nicer things you can do for your holiday guests than serve them a delicious, unctuous terrine of foie gras around the holiday season. And yet, strangely enough, a few twisted, angry people would like to take your foie gras away. These fanatical, stealth vegan extremists believe that the forced feeding of ducks to plump their livers is actually cruel. Some are even vandalizing small businesses, threatening chefs and their families, and convincing gutless politicians to outlaw something they've never even tried. In short, they think foie gras is bad, and the people who raise it, sell it, and cook it are evil. Not so, I say. To prove it to you, I'm taking you to the Hudson Valley Foie Gras Farm, located in Sullivan County, New York, so we can see the process for ourselves. And we won't be alone.
This makes me happy.
My good friend and legendary supplier of gourmet provisions to the very best restaurants, Ariane Degas, will be joining us.
Come on.
Ariane is owner of D'Artagnan, a purveyor of fine foods, including foie gras. She's nice. She likes animals. She's not evil. Foie gras and the traditional foods of the Gascony region of France are in her family history, going back 7 generations of chefs and restaurateurs.
Foie gras is really in the tradition of where I come from, and this is really what I know. So.
We're going to get to the bottom of this controversy once and for all.
So I like that Bourdain actually visits a farm and talks to the people who grow these animals and feed them, and they show you footage of this. And by the way, this is all over YouTube if you want to see it. It's from the Bourdain holiday special last year. But the reason I wanted to put these together is because PETA will use a figure like Roger Moore, well-loved as James Bond, just to show, you know, how cruel this is and how much bullshit that they're feeding you here, that they hope you'll believe it. And then they use grainy footage that looks dark and desolate and just downright cruel. I mean, there's happiness in the Bourdain clips. The PETA stuff just makes me want to put a tube down my throat.
Foie gras, which means fatty liver, is a painful liver disease that should be treated by a veterinarian, but is instead cruelly and intentionally induced on foie gras factory farms throughout the world. As revolting as it is to eat an animal's diseased organ, the cruel treatment of the birds is even more disturbing. Ducks and geese on foie gras farms are confined to tiny crates and cages that are often so small that the birds can't spread a single wing. They're packed inside dark, filthy sheds where they live surrounded by their own waste without access to so much as a blade of grass or a breath of fresh air. Imagine having pipes jammed down your throat and food pumped directly into your stomach repeatedly so that you felt as if you might explode.
Oh, dude, listen, I felt that the other night at Bazaar. Like they were sticking a pipe down my throat and feeding me until I might explode. But I'll tell you what, I'd have died happy, just like the geese.
This is what young ducks and geese endure every day solely to satisfy the demand for foie gras. Through this painful force-feeding process, birds have as much as 3 pounds of food pumped into their small bodies every day. In human terms, that's roughly 45 pounds of pasta every single day until they develop a disease that causes their livers to enlarge up to 10 times their normal size. The pipes scrape along the inside of the terrified birds' throats, causing intense pain, bruising, and deep gashes.
Hey, I'll tell you something. I may have grown up with foie gras liver. You know how much pasta I was forced to eat as a kid? I mean, if you're a kid in an Italian home for dinner, you're hosed. I mean, I hope you haven't eaten all day, because the mountain of pasta that they're going to pile in front of you and force feed you with would choke a moose. And you know, I didn't even realize until I started playing these clips. I mixed these two. Here are two guys, once tough guys, now they're soft, And Bourdain, even though he's getting the warm fuzzies with Rachel Ray, he's still 10 times tougher sounding than Roger Moore, because he's snarky. But I wonder what Roger Moore's wife did to him to make him do this. I mean, look at this. This is James Bond. The guy used to ski downhill, shooting machine guns, drinking martinis, sleeping with European broads three at a time. Now he's defending ducks and geese for a bunch of tofu-eating liberals? Okay. Yeah, you're not pussy whipped. All right, so here's Bourdain giving you the real details on the process of how foie gras is created and what the animals are really going through.
Sorry, Anna. Tell me a little bit about the process. How old are the ducks when the liver is taken?
Well, the ducks live their first 9 weeks of their life in a regular farm together. And then after 9 weeks, they are taken inside. And there, it's another 2 to 3 weeks. And that's where the force feeding happens 3 times a day.
Now, the vegan activists who are using this as a spear point issue as step one to get all meat banned would have you believe that the ducks are nailed in place, connected to a tube, and jammed full of food for hours until they nearly explode. But this is what it's really like. It takes seconds. Same feeder every time, done by hand, and quick. You see worse in the pay-per-view film on the Hotel Channel. And that's people, for God's sake. But don't take my word for all this. Let's ask the experts.
So, Tony, this is Dr. Bartoff. He's a New York veterinarian.
So, Doctor, what's going on? They're, you know, I see the tube going down the throat, and I know a lot of people look at that, and the first thing they're thinking, oh, my, you know, that's ghastly. The duck must be choking.
If the duck were human, that would be a valid concern. But we need to remember that mammals and ducks are not the same. As mammals, we have a gag reflex to keep us from choking, from inhaling something in our windpipe. All of the waterfowl, their windpipe doesn't open in the back of their throat. It opens in the center of their tongue. When you put the tube down their throat, their tongue is out past that tube. They could be there for hours. They'll breathe.
And ducks have a tough lining in their throat, too, so the tube doesn't hurt. But what about the enlarged liver? Activists say it's a painful disease. Funny, they don't concern themselves with my liver.
You're feeding them more than they ordinarily would in nature.
It is true that they do store fat in their liver, but this is normal for the bird family. It is not normal for mammals, and this is another very important distinction.
Quality of life-wise, this is hardly, you know, the house of horrors up here. I mean, how bad is it on the spectrum? Is this cool?
No, not at all. These animals are not stressed. In fact, there have been studies in France that actually ducks in the wild are under more stress than these birds are in the feeding situation. I mean, the better you take care of this duck, the gentler you are caring for it, the better quality liver it's going to have.
So basically, cruelty to animals is the last thing you want in this when you're making good foie gras.
I mean, come on. Look at these happy-go-lucky little guys. They love it. Here you go, Quacky. Don't shove. Happy animal equals good quality foie gras. Unhappy, stressed out animal equals foie gras that neither me nor anybody I know is buying.
Yeah, now doesn't that make sense? I mean, why would people who actually know what good food tastes like, the French, why would they give us this idea in the first place? Of actually eating something from an animal that was suffering all of its life. That's how you know Peter's full of crap. And it's stupid that foie gras is being banned. Our country, the world, is getting soft. We're humans, man. We're top of the food chain. We eat animals. We always have eaten animals, and we always will. And you don't make it illegal, because then we're just going to eat it illegally. And you know that's going to happen. Look, you make drugs illegal. And look at the trouble we have in Mexico right now. Is that stopping anybody? No. You want the foodie mafia? Is that what you want? You want a complete ban on stuff that we like, and we'll have foodies selling this foie gras underground, and foie gras dealers pushing, you know, into people's homes and taking them hostage because they didn't pay their foie bill. That would be stupid, but that could happen. I mean, don't put it past us. We're worse than drug dealers. We'll pop a cinnamon frosted cap in your ass. It's goose liver, man. It's good. You should have some. I'll bet half the people at PETA hadn't even tasted it. If they did, they'd flip teams. They'd be with Bourdain.
Me no reiki.
Yeah, okay, I'm talked out. Oof, I wore myself out. Look at that. Hey, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Thanks for listening to my ramblings about the bazaar, farmers markets, and foie gras. I know I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but whatever. You know, that's how it is. That's how I'm going to be all my life. Music in this episode by Saliva. It's new metal. You like it? Buy it in the iTunes store. Go to our website, mylifeasafoodie.com. We'll take you right to it. and you can purchase it for 99 cents. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Eat foie. It's good for you. All those Saturdays when kids go out and play,